Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang sang. It's a nice Wendell Berry poem here. Wendell Berry's an American sage from Kentucky, a writer, poet, farmer. To go into the dark with the light is to know the light. To know the dark, go dark, go without sight, and find that the dark too blooms and sings and is traveled by dark. Is traveled by dark feet. And what wings? Dare wings? To go into the dark, poetry's like that. Takes a while for my old brain. To go into the dark with the light is to know the light. To know the dark, go without sight, and find that the dark too blooms and sings, and is traveled by dark feet and dark wings. Very nice. I like Wendell Berry. He's one of my favorites. Right, now I have to say something. I always find it difficult speaking around now because I feel I've kind of given too many concepts, and so I could whip out another list, but you can get kind of indigestion, Dharma talk indigestion, so okay. I never quite know what to say, but anyway, there's at least a question I can prime the pump a bit. Can you give some advice on jealousy? So I won't go into the details of that. So jealousy, well maybe you could just think about mudita, that I spoke earlier about the four Brahmaviharas. And four Brahmaviharas are the ways that we talk about the open heart, the heart which is not afflicted by fear and anger and things like that, the heart which is empathetic to life as it presents itself. So when we have a certain level of freedom, we are available to whatever life brings us, and I think that availability is a kind of empathy. So if I'm caught up within my own fears and desires, I certainly have to work on them. And in the working on like fear, as you begin to let go of fear and process fear and purify fear, which is a whole serious work that we do in this lifetime, but as that, say, that fear begins to dissipate and cease in consciousness, then the heart is obviously much more in touch. It's available, because it's not holding back, it's not contracted, it's not concerned about what you think about me and so on. So it's available, and I think that availability is empathy, isn't it? So if I'm talking with people and they're presenting to me questions in Dharma, the best answer I can give is by getting out of the way and being available to them as a human being and trying to listen. And that listening is empathy, isn't it? And from the listening, hopefully I'll have some intuition, I'll try something, I'll put out some ideas, I'll see how those ideas work or don't work. I'll watch the person's reaction to see, does it click, does it not click? And so empathy is is listening is communication. And so when we empathize with life and we're open to life, we have a certain sense of goodwill as opposed to ill will. I will not be empathetic to life if I already have a kind of chip on my old shoulder and have a sense of ill will, or I'm highly critical, or I'm cynical, or I'm dismissive. All that kind of mindset is obviously not goodwill, and it's not open-hearted, it's not empathetic. So when we notice that closing of the heart, the contraction of the heart, the lack of contact, then the first task is to listen to that, to create what you might call self-empathy, to allow yourself to know that. If I begin with an ideal that I should be empathetic in some kind of a way where I'm just in tune with everyone and everything, and I'm not there, then I can feel guilty about it and I can get into a kind of self-tyranny. I should be more empathetic, I should be more compassionate, I shouldn't be jealous. So the first step in Buddhist practices of the heart, craft of the heart, is always to empathize with the way things are, to listen to the way things are, to know the way things are, not just on an external level, but at a total level. And the total level is my own perceptions, my own emotions, and my own interpretation of life. And so that capacity to know the inner world is the mind, knowing the mind, as we've been considering. So the teachings on empathy kind of indicate the possibilities of the pure heart, the possibilities of a heart functioning from non-selfishness. They are antidotes to selfishness. But just doing these practices as a kind of replacement therapy usually doesn't work, because first of all, you just have to recognize negativity as it arises. So the antidote to jealousy, we say, is mudita. And mudita is the empathy we have for beauty, for joy, for success. So for instance, I was coming out of my kuti, and just as I came onto the porch, there's this fabulous pigeon, and he was taking an updraft, and he grabbed it, and then he went around and dove down and then boop, sat on a branch. It's just beautiful, just lovely. And that feeling is mudita. That feeling where I get out of the way and I participate with an open heart in beauty is what I would consider to be mudita, an appreciation. Now with people, that would be probably best, we notice it in ourselves, probably with children. So Ajahn Khuslo does some lovely, Ajahn Khuslo, most of you I think know him, he does some really lovely work with children, and he's just an amazing guy. He had them make a geodesic dome, 12-sided, and did dependent origination with them, and they're 10 years old.
Wow.
How do you pull that off? But I think the biggest fun for the kids was just to crawl into the geodesic dome and just have fun. Now, just seeing Ajahn Khuslo teaching kids, and he's very good, he's wonderful. And the kids just having a great old time, and I couldn't get my head around how he could possibly do this. So there's a tremendous sense of mudita, both for him, for the whole situation, for the kids, the kind of lovely charm of these kids, and they come to the monastery quite often. So that we, I think, we feel, don't we? When we see situations like that, I think children can quite often draw that out. Jealousy, then if you look at jealousy is the way the heart closes. So jealousy is that energy which, what do they call it, the tall poppy syndrome? Where if anyone starts to look successful, you slice them down. So there's cynicism, jealousy. A Buddhist take on that would be when someone's happy, you say to them, it'll change. Buddhist put there. Right? It's not self. And jealousy is a very, very, very unhappy state of mind. It's very unhappy. It's very insecure. It's very, very divisive. Very destructive. Jealousy can lead to destructive gossip. You're just kind of planting stories of undermining situations. It can be very, very ugly. Very ugly. And so quite often we will experience that kind of jealous anger coming at us. Because people aren't wise, because people aren't training their hearts. And one of the difficulties in opening the heart is that you do become very sensitive and seemingly vulnerable. Right? And then if you are very open, and then someone blindsides you with some kind of cruel comment, it can really be very, very hard to take. And so as I was saying the other night, I just contemplating the way Ajahn Chah was, he was very, very open, but he was also very, very forthright and strong. And I often contemplate, so what's the combination there? Why is it that a great teacher can be open but be untouchable? As I was saying the other night, you didn't mess with this man. Because he just, there was nothing to mess with, maybe. There was nothing you could touch. So there was a kind of fearlessness and it's hard to explain. It's around the concept of anatta. There's no one there, which is really kind of hard to explain. But the more there is someone there to be hurt, the more there's a sense of vulnerability, then that vulnerability you have to look at. So as you open up your heart, you can feel very, very vulnerable. And to do that, you have to be safe. You have to be very, very safe. If you're not safe, then that closeness is kind of survival, isn't it? I don't say these things in a pub. The lads would destroy me. And I was thinking, actually, what a privilege it is to be able to teach, because I can say really sincere things. And you can't, in many situations, social situations, you can't really be sincere, because people will just be cynical and so on. So to actually be sincere and open-hearted sometimes socially is just not appropriate. Just not appropriate, you can't do it. But when we do feel vulnerable then, and we sometimes you begin to open the heart and feel vulnerable, then that's an aspect of fear. And that aspect of fear, if it is awoken to, in a safe way, and one can abide with the awareness of fear as a condition, begin to see that the way our personality quite often is structured, the way it manifests in society, is to be safe and secure and not get hurt. So we have personalities that manifest from fear. So when that fear becomes conscious, then I think it's actually a very, very good thing. I was speaking to someone in interviews that feeling kind of vulnerability and fear, other people don't seem to feel that. But if you look at sometimes people who are maybe really aggressive or divisive or jealous, you wonder what underlies their need to be so cruel and destructive. Why do they need to keep coming out that way? I'm not sure, but I think oftentimes it is fear overlaid with anger, overlaid with arrogance and such. So I think there's a kind of advantage to to being fearful. There's no advantage to being attached to fear, but there is an advantage to actually being conscious of things, being fully conscious of it. The strength of fear that we feel, or whatever, depends karmically. Different people have different aptitudes and such like, but when these energies become conscious, then that's a chance for us to go beyond the personality that gets that comes into force from fear or from jealousy. Because if you look at it, if you're nervous or afraid, you say something or do something to cover that up in a social situation. But as meditators and contemplatives, we can get a hold of fear and just let it be as it is, then what we're doing is we're beginning to purify the heart. One of the simplest formulations in Buddhism is do good, refrain from doing harm, and purify the heart. So when these energies come up, the unenlightened person, the uninformed person, the person who's not taking responsibility for their mind, just start to think fearful thoughts and create strategies that are seemingly safe. So they worry, or they kind of get arrogant, and they do all kinds of interesting things. So humans can do things like that. So being conscious of that, so in terms of like jealousy and so on, if one is feeling jealousy oneself, then it's very, very important not to just dismiss that as being wrong. So most contemplatives that I meet are very good people, and they have a high sense of conscience, a high sense of morality, and usually a strong tendency to self-disparagement. Maybe it comes with the package of getting enlightened. Because I think it's better self-disparagement than just arrogance. At least there's some critical faculty looking at things. But self-disparagement itself is not healthy, because it's still aversion, it's still personality view, it's still taking all this stuff personally. So what happens if one is experiencing jealousy oneself, the contrast to mudita is interesting. You know, so what you try to do is feel the heart when it is glad for the well-being of someone else, and then feel the heart when it feels intimidated by the well-being of someone else. So, you know, so maybe I would come to this monastery and think, oh, Ajahn Tiridhamo, he's got this lovely monastery, and I've got one shower for 8 people. So I think, bloody hell, it ain't fair. And that's not a very joyous way to think. But actually, when I come here and I see how well he's taken care of it, the monks take care of the place, they do love the place, and I see that beautiful building that we have meal in, I say, oh, isn't that great? Isn't that lovely? So I can feel, that's mudita, isn't it lovely that we have this place and this is, the place has grown that way. And when I connect to that, I see, well, look at that. You can kind of expand your joy by plugging into other people's joy, other people's goodness. And if the other happens, I feel intimidated or jealous, or you begin to see that kind of contraction of the heart, what kind of thoughts come from that, what kind of attitudes, what kind of gossip, what kind of self-perceptions come up from that. And you feel the contracted heart. There's this contraction. You begin to see, okay, that contraction needs to be looked at. That closing of the heart. And it really is. It really is here. Then it goes up into language, justifying language, self-disparaging language. So, but if the heart closes, it closes. And to have the capacity to empathize with the closed heart, rather than to disparage it, judge it, analyze it, get rid of it, reorganize it, do anything about it, but actually to witness to it in this empathetic way is the beginning of liberating the heart, because the heart's tendency to be jealous comes from insecurity, comes from fear, comes from strong self-view, leads to suffering, And when I finally can contact that, the energies of that, then I'm beginning to be bigger than that. I'm beginning to abide as the witness to that. And abiding as witness allows for purification. So the situation triggers off jealousy. And so that situation is actually very helpful. It's very helpful to indicate, look at that. With this as condition, then this feeling of intimidation or jealousy arises. So that's beginning to look at Dharma as a flow of conditions. So with this as condition, with this person, this feeling arises. Now if you're into idealism, if you're attached to idealism, then you create an ideal that I should be full of mudita, and I shouldn't have this. Now that's not empathy, that's tyranny. Self-tyranny, isn't it? It shouldn't be this way. And that's not mindfulness. So then that's another form of delusion. So with this as condition, jealousy arises. With jealousy as condition, another delusion arises. I shouldn't be this way. It doesn't work. Self-view. But as a contemplative, as a observer of energy patterns and emotional patterns, you begin to just know, this is contraction. It's unpleasant, very unpleasant, but it feels this way. And the capacity to hold to that is part of what we're doing in meditation. We're developing a capacity to be with the unpleasant and not just shy away from it, blame it, compensate it, but just really, really embrace and feel it. So as we do that, the very fact that we can do that is compassion. So the tendency of that mindset is to go towards jealousy, but now we're bringing into the picture compassion. It may not feel like compassion, but it is inclusive. It's allowing this to be. And so that very situation, which before we'd feel maybe guilty about it, or shouldn't feel jealousy, begins to see the value of it. It's really, really valuable because now this thing, this jealousy thing, I can know it, and I can know it, and I can know it. And as that energy is known, it is no longer given any nutriment. We talk about nutriment and food. We don't feed it anymore, either by believing it or trying to repress it. We don't feed it anymore, so its energy still has momentum because of the way it's been conditioned into our minds, but that momentum is no longer pushed along, no longer encouraged. It just is, and it dies out. It has no more fuel, we say. And in the dying, in the ceasing of that particular energy, our heart has release from that, release from some of that fear, and then the natural result of that is that we're available and empathy can function through that process. And that's the same pattern I talked about earlier. So it's really important not to just, if one is feeling those things, not to just be a goody-good Buddhist and think that you should be nice and sweet and loving, like some kind of puppy Labrador or something, lick everyone's face all the time, life isn't like that. So that kind of real honesty, but the way you come to that honesty is you see this as Dharma rather than as self. When we say, when I see it as self, then I always make these self judgments, or I believe in it. So my jealousy, if I believe in it, then I start to rip the other person down behind their back or in front of their face. The other is, and that's self-view, you don't really deserve that. And I saw your cousin and she's a creep. And that's a kind of total believing in it. But the other way also is a believing in it. I shouldn't be like this. I shouldn't feel like this. And that we call what we call Sakaya Ditti, or personality view. And that's that's not seeing Dharma as Dharma. That's just getting caught up in an ego sense. So what we're trying to do in the contemplative life is no longer take that ego position, but just see that with this kind of stimulation, I get these feelings. And these feelings are painful, and they're not wholesome, and I'm going to try to see if I can not reinforce them. Vice versa, I see Ajahn Kusalo playing with the kids. He's having a great time, kids are having a great time, and parents are really happy, and just a natural, isn't that great? And I notice that feeling of connection and wholesomeness, and realize that that's worthy of cultivating. That's really a wholesome state of mind. It brings freedom, it brings happiness, it's a foundation for peace. And so I try to encourage that. I try to maybe strengthen that by imaging it or bringing it up as a meditation theme. And you can see how working in those ways, that unwholesome energy is recognized but not fed. So its karma dies, its momentum dies out, and that wholesome energy is encouraged, and the mind is strengthened through that. Yeah, natural process. It's not rocket science. It's not voodoo, you know. It's just simple understanding of cause and effect. It is oftentimes arduous if the feelings are kind of so ingrained. So if you look at someone who has suffered child abuse or something like that, some of their coping mechanisms, as we've all read or experienced or seen people. Those coping mechanisms are so strongly overlaying all the fear that it's very hard to get past those. They're very difficult, you know? And so there are degrees of this. There's a whole range of these kinds of situations that we face as human beings. If we can be fully conscious of them, that's a great gift. So rather than think, if I didn't have this fear, I'd be happy. Yeah, but you say, okay, this is a chance to understand this quivering of the heart, this contraction of the heart, because it's conscious now. So the attitude of the contemplative is like to really take this opportunity and to learn from it. But what if the jealousy is coming towards us? It's not us who feel jealousy, but others who are divisive and destructive. And that's a sad part of society. You know, people can be very petty, very, very petty. And they can, nowadays, they can blog. And they can send emails. Yeah? And it's always been that way. And what can you do about that? Well, as I was saying last night, you can be loyal. It's amazing how people lose their loyalty with a wee bit of gossip. You know, they often believe the most perverse gossip because it's fun. It's more interesting than someone who's moral. I don't know, but so loyalty is an interesting one, isn't it? You know, as some kind of negative gossip circles in a society. Well, what is this? Where am I? The person who's telling me this, if they were telling that about me to someone, they probably are telling that about me to someone. You know, you start to think, well, wait a minute. What's true here? You know, what is true? So there's a kind of being streetwise too. But if you're the target of that, you know, and you hear it, it's going to be very, very painful. So like things like backstabbing. You know, you're really, maybe you're consciously kind to someone and they smile at you, and then you learn that they've actually betrayed you. Now that's a very painful, betrayal is a very, very painful thing. And it's very hard to heal, isn't it? But if you're going to be free, somehow you've got to have enough mindfulness to deal with it all, right? So like if you think about those times, and most of us have been betrayed, I think I have, I've had that experience. It's awful, to say the least, and it arises in a rush of emotion, and it's felt in the body, and then the mind goes berserk with thought, you know, either blame or unfair or hatred or whatever. So when something like that, an attack on you or character comes, and your mind does go berserk, well, there's not really much you can do except keep the precepts. Like, don't kill them. Just wait. Don't say anything. Just do some serious walking meditation and let it cool down. Yeah, so that is, there's not much you can do about it. Once something like that's been triggered, so if someone is in a marriage and they find that the partner's been adulterous, that's just, you know, it's your mind's going to take, it's going to take a while to process that. So then you just kind of breathe and don't do anything dumb. Wait. But that whole memory trace might last for years. Might last for years, you don't know. Can do. No, it's not uncommon. Memory traces are like that. Memory's always there. I was saying to someone, every meditation I get a memory of my mom dying. She died in March. It's not emotional, it's just this tableau of death comes through my mind almost every meditation. And that's just memory. It's nothing, you know, nothing good or bad. It's just natural. It's just natural. You know, if I didn't have that, just that's just memory, and I went into that memory, and I started to bring myself into that painful situation, then those emotions would start to be triggered off. And if I was heedless about that, I would start to think, and the whole memory trace would become a reliving. When my mom died, the months just after she died, the memory traces were very emotional and very powerful. Now they're just tableaus. So memory is the way it is. We are memory beings. And those kind of narrative memories of strong, painful experiences do come up into consciousness. And at times they have a tremendous emotional impact on us. And again, the skill of the meditator is to see it as an opportunity to become someone who is no longer vulnerable, I guess, like Ajahn Chah. Someone who these things go through them rather than impact them. And so if someone has been really hurt by the words and unkindness of others, the jealousy of others and so on, socially, you can do a little bit. You can try to call them, but if they're kind of powerful people, quite often their energies can be demonic. You can't mess with them sometimes. You don't know. Sometimes you can say something in a group. So that's a social situation. But as a contemplative, you always try to use it to become more strong. And that's an adage. I know it's a kind of cliche, but the cliche is one more growth experience and I'll be dead, right? But I think the principle for me in the contemplative life is that each situation that comes, emotional, physical, mental, whatever, can I use it to strengthen and deepen awareness, right? Strength, because if I can, then those situations won't blow me away and my mind will become more and more expansive, less and less contracted. And when a powerful social situation, painful situation, like, because that's what the person was indicating in this question, then socially do what you can, but you have to make a determination to somehow look at the vulnerability, look at the fear, look at the pain, and be the witness to that in a way where that is no longer fueled. And you begin to have this strength where you are unshakable. So we call it the unshakable deliverance of the heart. And that doesn't come that easily because the heart gets shaken by things. So I've just been traveling in Thailand, and I just heard several very disturbing stories of just misinformation from petty people influencing large communities in very, very negative ways. Just this mad kind of gossiping. It was really, really sad. I kept on thinking, what about loyalty? Where does loyalty come into this? And one of the ways to look at loyalty is loyalty to a commitment to the Dhamma. And as I was saying last night, a loyalty to the precepts. Say, you know, I'm loyal to concord and things like that. So when someone is not speaking in concord, not speaking in ways which are according to the precepts, then you can ask them, are you a Buddhist? And are you a Theravada Buddhist? And have you ever heard of Musavada? And, you know, quote them line and verse, and it maybe embarrass them. But oftentimes, it's someone who's not really interested in the precepts, someone who doesn't have a reflective mind, believes in their delusions and so on. And then you have to protect yourself from that kind of person. You know? And that's why we talk about Kalyanamitta. Kalyanamitta is the idea of spiritual friends. You know, beings who, spiritual friend is one, you ask them for $5, they'll give you 10. You know, it's a friend who will, if you're being disparaged, the friend will defend you in that situation. It's a friend who will talk well of you, away from you. It's a friend who will encourage you in Dhamma. Like if I'm venting to someone about something, I'm really upset, and they say, yeah, you're absolutely right, go for the jugular. That's not a spiritual friend, right? That's a friend you have at the bar. But a spiritual friend would listen, and they'd say, yeah, but how does your guts feel? Or how's your breathing now? Or, yeah, that's difficult, I know, but let's go for a walk. It doesn't, like a spiritual friend doesn't feed the delusion, doesn't keep going there with that, helps you through. So spiritual friendship then is a way of both protecting yourself and creating a community of mutual support. Within any social group, you'll always get hypocrisy. You know, so you'll get people who will say one thing and do another thing, and that's just part of the human realm. So the human realm can be pretty ugly at times, can be very, very beautiful at times, just the way it is. But how can I become, how can I become like Ajahn Chah? Like, not try to imitate them. What is it about a great teacher that doesn't get blown away? You think of like the Dalai Lama, the stuff he's had to endure about China, and it's awful. And yet you meet him, and he's just so radiant and kind. And this. I remember when he did his first trip to Auckland, or was it here in Wellington? It might have been in the Wellington. I think it was in the Wellington Marae. You know, some of you might have been there, but I was in the... When he came to the Marae on... Is it Lambton Quay down there? One of the streets by the docks.
Maybe to the Marae.
Maybe, yeah, okay. And he was... I was... He arrived and I was part of the visiting party with His Holiness, and there were our monks and the Tibetan Sangha and some lay people. And one of the elders, a woman from the Marae, brought us in, and she began to sing up to the hill where the lodge house was, whatever it's called, I guess that's called the Marae. And an elder woman there was singing back, so they were kind of calling back and forth. And... It was a funny scene because as we are walking up the hill, this young warrior shows up with a grass skirt, and highly tattooed, spear in his hand, and sticks his tongue out at His Holiness. This is the kind of, you know, it's theater. It's great, great fun. And His Holiness goes, So they're processing up the hill, and the two elders are calling each other, and you know, it was really, really lovely. And everyone's just playing their part, right? It's just this kind of lovely two cultures, Tibetan, Maori, coming together. And then we got up to the Marae, and then the if I remember correctly, the protocol was that we sat on one side, and the local folk sat on the other side, the people of the Marae. And then they had a speaker, and the speaker spoke, and then he stood up and spoke, and then the whole group sang, and then we had a speaker, then we sang, and we did that three times. So their first speaker, I think, was a professor from university, and he was very eloquent in talking about the destruction of Maori society and culture and so on. His Holiness spoke in the same way. And then His Holiness asked, we did our chanting, and it was really quite nice. But what I did notice about His Holiness is he had a lot of joy. And the other man had a lot of sadness. And there's not to say it's not a sad situation, but I just felt in His Holiness somehow, in his own practice, he's taken on something very complicated, but he's also got his kind of his way of upliftment, which is transcendent. At least that was my feeling there. So those are the kind of role models we have, and you can't replicate them, but you can't think, what is it about a human being who can be so compassionate and yet not be vulnerable, yet not be a doormat, and be very strong. Very strong in his answers, very strong in meeting people, but not through aggression. It's quite marvelous, and I do think the place is fear. I think it is that the fearless heart, which can be both open and not vulnerable, because in Buddhism we'd say that the whole sense of self has fallen away, so there's no one to be vulnerable. So when we get impacted, I think that sense of insecurity we need to look at. But we can only look at that in safety. If the social situation is not safe, then you just can't do it. It's not possible. A monastery offers that. It's one of the things I've always thought about a monastery, is that you have this kind of possibility of all you gotta do is show up. Right? You don't have to be happy. You don't have to be nice. You have to be nice to some extent. But, you don't have to be a personality. So if you feel vulnerable, especially in a retreat, if you're really feeling shaky, great. This is the place. Feel shaky, fine. You still get fed. Right? Lots of tissue boxes around. No problem. And that kind of coming to those vulnerable places of our heart in a larger social situation, it's quite hard because you get more and more protective, and then you have to fight these people who are attacking you and so on. But notice in any group, when there is someone who is deeply settled in their mind and strong and confident and unshaking, they can say powerful things from a good place, not from aggression. And their voice, the voice can be heard. If a situation is just like immoral and cruel, then you just have to get out of there. Like if it's a war or something like that. So the balance there in these Brahma Viharas, when we talk about goodwill, compassion, appreciation, sympathetic joy, mudita, and equanimity. So equanimity is that kind of peacefulness of heart with the open heart. And how do you train in equanimity? That would be the question. So equanimity isn't something you just get off the Buddhist bookshelf. I'll have some equanimity, thanks very much. It's more complicated than that. And I think equanimity begins by acceptance. If I do experience a lot of jealousy, and that comes up, it's a kind of thing that where does jealousy cease? Well, jealousy ceases when there is first of all acceptance of it and non-attachment, non-clinging. And the clinging is the self-thoughts, the storylines. So one feels the jealousy, and that's the beginning of equanimity, acceptance. And then jealousy comes up and comes up and comes up, and it's not fed and not fed. And then the conditions and causes for jealousy cease. There's no more jealousy. Equanimity is even deeper. But it comes through acceptance, knowing, rather than thinking I should be equanimous. And that's one of the real difficulties from people who are sincere in the practice, is they become very idealistic. They have ideals about how they should be, and then their thinking mind compares that ideal to how it is, and then they get into a mental thing of self-judgment, and Buddhism becomes a very kind of sad, puritanical affair. and joyless, it becomes very joyless. So the idea that a mindfulness practice is just control, or just being a good person, is a very shallow and wrong view of Buddhism. Buddhist practices of mindfulness and meditation is fully engaging this whole human experience. It's like fully feeling like something like jealousy with courage, rather than kind of having some ideal that you're always trying to work towards. And this is the danger of as I've been saying, too much adherence to book knowledge, where we get some idea of perfection and then we try to shove our psyches into this definition. You can never do it. You can never do it. As opposed to reflection. So once we see that that which upsets us is the place where we can develop equanimity, once we understand that, you have to understand that, rather than self-disparagement, then what arises in our consciousness is a kind of determination, adhitana, a determination to do the work with this particular pattern. And as we do that, there's a kind of confidence in the witnessing now, because it is work on the path. It's just not, oh no, there I go, I'm jealous again. When there is no kind of direction, when our vehicle is kind of rudderless, every now and then we feel good, and we feel jealous, and oh, I don't know what to do. So there has to be this kind of, when we chant, we say, ujjupatipanno, a kind of straight practice, right to the mark. This is suffering, this is the path which puts an end to suffering, the mind turning to the mind. And then that engagement with our difficulties is very, very wholesome. It's very, very skillful. But it's not fun. It's not happy. It's not easy. It's arduous. It's very, very arduous. But there is something that I think that arises in us that says, yeah, this is the work. This is good work. This is worthy. As opposed to the mind, which is just self-disparaging all the time with its kind of idealism. So look, you know, be very careful of idealism. Have ideals as goals for reflection, but don't attach to ideals. Attachment to ideals gets you to the should be, and the should be becomes this inner tyranny. Should be this and should be that. So I sometimes ask people, how's your practice? And they look down. So what did I say? You know, like I can read their mind that they got angry last week or something. when I say, how's your practice? Are you being more aware? Not, are you goody-good-two-shoes kind of thing. You know, are you more aware? Are you more aware of your humanity? More aware of your emotions? And more aware of what it means to be a human being? What does it mean to be a human being and be incarnate in this body? And that's not an ideal. That's the kind of waking up to Dhamma. So Dhamma, we say, is the way things are. And these energies of jealousy, be they, whether they come towards us or they come from within, are really nasty bits of the human predicament. You know, they're much worse than a broken arm. And yet, they're all important. They're all very, very important. And the more we contemplate these Brahma Viharas, I think they're a beautiful teaching. And this teaching is, I think, of a piece, because it's about both, like, karuna is compassion, and karuna is about the way we act in the world, in compassion. Mudita is about the uplift, you know, there is beauty and joy. So like, you can use beauty, to uplift the mind. But if you attach to beauty, then that's idolatry. That's what we mean by idolatry in religious language. When you focus on to something and think that something is what it's about. But when the pigeon flies, does its beautiful fly, and I look at it, my mind opens, the pigeon's pointing to my consciousness. It's not about the pigeon. If I think it's about the pigeon, I'll start raising pigeons. See what I mean? Take the Buddha here. Right? Now, most Westerners would rather have one Buddha, right? We've got a note. Someone gave us a note. Get rid of the other Buddhas. Thank you. Thank you for your instruction. And so aesthetics becomes idolatry, if you want to follow this along. The Buddha image is, to me, it's beautiful. And aesthetically, there are some Buddhas I like more than other Buddhas. Aesthetically, I like oftentimes less Buddhas than more Buddhas. But aesthetics points to the outside. So when people come in here and they say, oh, I don't like that one, but I like that one, and maybe I can get one. That's aesthetics. But when you look at a Buddha image and it awakens you to what you're feeling, it awakens you to the feeling, oh, like or dislike, more or less, and you awaken to that, then that's iconography or symbology points back to you. See what I mean? So, any Buddha is equally valid, right? Because it's pointing back to the mind which is awake. So, beauty can do that, or beauty can be something that you attach to. A piece of music can be very opening and uplifting, but then you want to buy the CD, naturally. And then how many times do you play it? Because you want to get back to that. And it becomes jaded. And you buy another one, which is what consumerism's about. But nature's very good that way. You look at like a tree and just let the tree come to you. What's it pointing to? It's not about the tree, it's about your mind. So idolatry then is like looking at the object. So when you come into the shrine room and you look at the Buddha and you bow to it, if you just let that be a symbol for the awakened mind, and if you like it, fine. If you dislike it, fine. We're not going to change. And see the mind which complains, or which is inspired, or whatever. Then you get beyond aesthetics, beyond attachment, and then beauty points back to your own mind. Otherwise, it's all just much of our culture is very idolatrous in that way. You know, we worship consumerism. Apples and things like that, because we're focused on the object, and then the object changes and we need to rearrange it. But in religious life, we're using the object to come back to the heart, to come back to that purity of consciousness. So mudita, that's one way you could look at mudita. When I see Ajahn Kusala enjoying his kids' class and the kids enjoying it, and what is he showing me? He's reflecting me when my heart is open, when I'm not contracted with my own self-concerns. And then I get wrapped up with some critical problem and I'm grumping or whatever, then that situation is showing me selfishness. It's reflecting back to me. And so we go back to that theme that we had in the retreat. The path is the mind turning to the mind, and the result of the path is the end of suffering. And turning in that way. All right, I'll leave that for your reflection.
Sadhu, sadhu.